Welcome to the 17th episode of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast, a show co-hosted by Eric Drysdale and Jared Hunter. We aim to have interesting conversations with the people we know in a wide range of fields, including business, politics, and music. In today's episode, we are joined by Seth Kitamura, a young jazz musician based in Vancouver, British Columbia. We'll be discussing with Seth his recent studies, jazz in general, and get his take on starting out life after school. Why don't we start with you telling us a bit about yourself?
So my name is Seth Kitamura. I'm a musician in Vancouver, British Columbia. I attended 4 years of university at Capilano University for the jazz studies program. I play the drums and piano. I play in a band called Felicia and the Jazz Rejects in Vancouver and play some local shows. And that's about it.
And you also composed the intro music for this very podcast.
I did compose the intro music for the podcast. There we go. Putting some of that that sweet, sweet music school knowledge that I paid a lot of money for.
To good use, That's the most important credit, for sure.
Those synthetic trumpets just really bring this podcast together.
They do. They really do.
With that introduction, we're wondering, and you've just recently graduated, so you're pretty fresh out of finishing the program. It's probably still pretty relevant to you. What made you really motivated to start in this program and pursue this educational path? Because, there's no guarantee what you're going to do with it. Life has a lot of varying forks in the road. But do you want to just give us a bit of the sense of how you came to that decision and how you ended up where you are?
Yeah, so I spent a lot of time in high school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. There were a lot of paths open, I think, to me at the time, and I guess to a lot of people when you're younger. But I had a very good high school band teacher who was very supportive of learning. And so I became extremely interested in music, and more specifically kind of jazz music. I'd spent time when I was younger learning the piano a lot of years. Probably I started when I was maybe 3 or 4. I'm not totally sure. It was a long time ago. But yeah, and then I'd been kind of sort of into it and had kept going, and I tried other instruments and thought it was pretty neat. But my high school band teacher, he was a drummer and was very supportive about learning the drums, teaching me how to play the drums. And I was very lucky to have been afforded the opportunity to get what was essentially private lessons on almost a daily basis from my teacher at the time. So that was kind of big. And he opened up this path. He had done the program at Capilano before. I'm not sure how long ago that was, but he had done the program and had said, hey, you can pursue this at a higher level. You can go and do post-secondary education for music. And that was something that was beneficial for him. And he saw that I was passionate about it, and so he pushed for that. So from about the time of kind of grade 9-ish, end of grade 8, kind of grade 9, I thought, well, I kind of want to do this. And so I pursued it pretty heavily after that.
And Seth, let me ask, my sense is that people who go to do music training after high school, some post-secondary form of it, they're, I don't know if prodigies is the right word, but as you say, they've been playing around on musical instruments since the age of 3 or 4. Is that about 99% of people in your program? Or is there people who at 16 say, you know what, I'm going to actually make music my professional career? Does that happen?
It's probably actually a lot less than you'd think. I can't actually remember. It was, you just said it, but what would you say, 90% probably? I think it's probably closer to, a lot closer to maybe an exact figure. I don't know, somewhere in the realm of 20 to 50. I'd say it's under 50% actually. Most people in the program that I went to were people kind of close to my age or a little bit older. Maybe they'd taken a gap year or two. Not that much older, but they'd kind of pretty much decided that they were going to do it in maybe grade 11 or 12. That was kind of an option for them. And I say I'd kind of chosen in grade 8 and 9. I kind of thought about it and I thought I was going to do it. And then I kind of went around to other things, but I kept playing. And ultimately that was what I ended up choosing. But a lot of people choose it later on. And actually, you might be surprised to know that there is a fair a fair percentage of people, probably 15 to 20% of people, I'd say. I mean, not like the classes aren't huge, so in my year of about 40 people, this is probably about 5 or 10 people, maybe, who were a fair amount older, kind of in their late 20s, or even some people who were coming back to it in their like later stages of life. Like there was a woman in my first year, and she must have been in her 50s or 60s coming back to do it. I think a lot of people, it's kind of a snap thing, you know. People kind of don't like, at least a lot of my friends, you know, people don't necessarily see it as like a strong path. I mean, some people think, oh, I'm going to become a teacher is one of the main kind of paths into it. And so then they decide, oh, I like teaching music or that sort of thing. Or maybe they often don't really have kind of something lined up, and they think, well, maybe my family, or I feel like I want to go pursue higher education, and I'm not really sure what that would look like. They kind of come into the program, or maybe they've even tried some post-secondary and thought, I don't really, you know, these kind of arts things aren't for me. Or I had a friend who did, you know, 2 years of an economics degree, and then decided he really liked playing music, and so he left his economics degree and came to pursue this. And he'd even taken some gap years before that, so he's probably, I think he's about 25 right now. But for a lot of people, it's maybe not, it's a known path. I mean, people know about that path through it, but they don't strictly choose it very early on.
Interesting. So, I mean, you touched on that you kind of were interested in it earlier, and you'd stuck with like the drumming extra lessons or kind of extracurricular from like an early period. Do you think for you personally that was very important? Or do you think even if you'd stopped, you probably would have come back to it?
In terms of like, had I stopped playing the drums in high school, would I have come
Yeah,
back to it
maybe
later
like
on?
grade
Or
10, you were like, oh no, I'm thinking about something else. And then, you know, you just kind of stopped doing the drums, maybe not entirely, but you know, not quite as regular as you had been. Do you
well,
think
I
you would have come
think
back?
that's a good question. I think that probably down the line is like a lot of people, you know, a lot of people I work with, even that I've talked to, you know, a lot of people who have exposure to music in school, they think, well, at least they talk to me and they see we talk about music, or they are kind of exposed to that, and they think to themselves, oh, that was, I remember that being fun. I remember enjoying that, or that's something I should maybe get back into as something to do. I think probably I would have found my way back to it eventually, maybe. But I guess obviously I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I know a lot of people who gave up on it and then it never really left their life anyway, right? And so they would always put all of their spare time and effort into it. Yeah, I just think like it seems like it kind of rings true that you would have found it, come back to it anyway. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting perspective. The other question too, I had like you spent all of that effort into it and you've gone through this path. But now that you're here at the end and you've graduated, you've completed this program, are there opportunities that you feel like you've missed, or do you think that there were choices you made that you think maybe weren't as worthwhile? And that could even just be like maybe within the program, there are courses you didn't think were as good, or things that you put a lot of effort into that didn't really turn out or something.
I think that yes, but I don't worry about it too much because I think I did the best that I could. The program was a lot of courses and involved like a lot of extracurricular work. I mean, it's a bit of a strange program in that way, where it's almost siloed into two separate streams of things you're supposed to be dealing with all at once, where you have to deal with academic courses, you know, writing papers and handing in assignments and doing those sorts of things. But then also, you're expected to spend a lot of personal time dealing with working on playing. And of course, sometimes that rolls into class work a little bit. And if you're really in, if you started the degree, you know, if I went back and did it again, I probably could be a lot more intentional about how I approach certain classes or dealt with certain things. But then again, I don't think I really would have been able to do a better job, if that makes sense, just because of the nature of the amount of information you receive and how necessary it is. Like, I'm not sure how to give a good overview about this, but basically, like, I think, and maybe you could correct me because I obviously haven't done a different degree program, but I think like often your university courses, you know, they kind of build on each other, right? And you get to the end and you're doing things that are built upon things that you learned before, right? Obviously, like you're doing more difficult, I don't know, you're doing more difficult math problems, or you're trying to deal with more difficult kind of issues, you know, like you're thinking about a social studies class, right? Or how do I kind of take this information and learn about it a different way, or these all these other things I know. Music is almost, it's almost more like a sport than like it's almost like you're going to school to learn how to do a sport, in that the game, quote unquote, that you're playing through the whole time, it doesn't change. Like I'm still doing the same things and dealing with the same things that I was at the very beginning in a lot of ways, and I will be dealing with those things for the rest of my life in terms of music. So, you know, I could go back and say to myself, well, I know all these things and I'm going to do it again in a more intentional way. But if I were to actually go back and start again without any of the knowledge I have now, it probably would end up going the same way, where I don't have enough time to deal with practicing and learning all the things that I need to practice and figuring out the right way to deal with certain practicing and certain kind of learning about music.
You're kind of saying like those mistakes that you made before were like learning how to learn music. So there wasn't really a way that you could get to where you are without having done that. Is it, I don't, maybe,
Yeah,
yeah.
that's a good way of putting it. It's also just so much time spent, right? Like, I mean, usually I don't even actually know what the baseline is for this, but what you must have taken, what, like 5 classes a semester?
Yeah, in my programs, it would have been, yeah, five is like the standard. Yeah.
Yeah, 'cause I was taking, in my first year, I was taking probably eight or nine classes.
How do
And
they, so how do they break up the workload with that? Is that because a lot of the
well,
music courses you have to take in parallel or something, or what's happening there?
no, well, here we could talk. I could just list them off. I think we can list them off and get all the way through the nitty-gritty. So I've taken a history class. I was taking a theory class. I was taking an ear training class.
And sorry, that
I
history, is
was,
that music history or is that an
yeah, sorry,
outside
it's a music history
music history?
course.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I was taking a music history course. I was taking a ear training course, theory course. I was taking a private music instruction class, like a drum lessons kind of thing. Then I was taking another private music instruction. I had learned piano already, so I tested out of the kind of core competency. They make you take like a competency piano class basically in first year, but I tested out of that, so I had to do piano lessons instead. And then I was in two different ensembles in that first year, and I had to, there was something else. But anyways, that was seven, and then you were supposed to take an elective. So I was supposed to take, and I did actually that first semester. I took 100 level English, I believe, that semester.
It really had an impact on you, I guess, that 100
I
level
really
English
did.
course.
Oh man, I really learned a lot in that 100 level English class, but it was at a horrible time. Anyways, I digress. But that's eight. Yeah, that's eight. I was taking eight classes. Oh, and a combo class. There you go, nine. The way that they structure the program in terms of how the university's concerned is a lot of those classes are 1.5 credit courses instead of the full three. So I like most of the classes that you take are 3 or 4 credit courses in like the rest of the university. But a lot of our courses would end up being credit and a half, which is kind of misleading for a lot of them. Often I would find that, oh, I'd take, there are some classes that I took that were 1.5 credit courses that would be even more than 3 credits worth of work. Like you think about the amount of hours. And especially if you didn't have a baseline knowledge of some of this stuff already, because like I said before, like a lot of people were kind of coming into this, you know, they'd played in school, but maybe didn't have a lot of formal training necessarily, or things like that. But you could spend so much time dealing with any one of those things, right? I think is the problem. Like the act of juggling is really it. And what I say, like optimizing courses earlier about, oh, going back and doing all the things I know now. What were the important things to be learning out of those courses? I didn't know. And so what it's become now is like, well, I have some of this information and I know about a way it's been presented to me. So I can go back and actually learn the right things now and clean up some of the, like, you know, dust out some of the corners and of knowledge that I haven't really, I didn't really actually deal with the right way the first time. Anyways, it just gets tough to juggle. But then there were other classes, right, where it would be a 3 credit course, and the way the teacher taught it, it was nothing. It was like no work, right? It could be no work if you didn't want it to be any work. And of course, you wouldn't get any better at these things, but you could slough off the class, and so people do, right?
That's interesting because I noticed when I did my theater degree forever ago, it is very different because, like, they basically try and take all the skills that you want for this task that would be theater that's not really traditional academia. And so they try and then force it into the structure that they need to for it to be a university course. So it sounds like with music, they've done a similar thing, except it sounds like they're even more loose than I experienced with these course values, right? Because if I'm understanding correctly too, with the numbers, like I think this was the same at York University where there was 1.5 credits is like a half course, and a 3 credit course would have been like a full course. But then you could do a 6 credit, but that would have been 2 terms kind of thing.
Yeah, we didn't do any of the 2-term things, but because but yeah, essentially there were some courses that were that way because you would need like they were supposed to be taken one after the other. Like a lot of the courses were that way, and everything kind of leads in. Like you almost don't stop taking any of those classes. Like you kind of do, and they kind of get replaced with other things, but you almost the classes change names, but it's the same thing.
Interesting. I guess I want to get a little bit more into the nitty-gritty because now, like, we put this podcast out there. Somebody's going to listen to it and they're going to be like, oh, I wanted to go to CAP. And here's this grad talking about CAP and I'm not getting any pro tips. Can you
Right.
give us what's the pro strats, Seth? What are the best pro strats that you got for future music students?
Well, the pro strat is what do you care about? Is deciding what's important because obviously all of it's important, but to some people, some things are going to be more important than to other people, right? If I wanted to go on to be a high school music teacher, then like, how good do I need to get at playing my scales? How good do I need to be at knowing all of this esoteric kind of harmony knowledge? Like, how well do I need to know the history of the music that I'm playing? I mean, I think that you have, in some ways, you have an obligation as a teacher to kind of be aware of a lot of those things, especially in a music context. I mean, that might just be a certain level of elitism, but I kind of don't think so. Because I don't necessarily mean strictly academic knowledge, but there's a certain level of knowledge of those things that are important, even in the kind of quote unquote non-academic music world, especially in terms of jazz music. It's pretty specific that way. But if your goal was to just teach in a high school, there are certain things that you need to get good at. Or you need to know about, and you need to kind of have a baseline knowledge of. But, then again, if I wanted to be a professional musician, some of the later courses, like how good do I need to be at conducting? Am I going to conduct a band? Am I going to conduct a string orchestra? Unlikely. Extremely unlikely. How good do I need to be at playing other instruments? Not really. I mean, there are some, obviously, that's like an edu there. I didn't say this earlier, but the program splits into kind of an education stream and a performance stream. So you don't necessarily take those courses. But again, there can be an emphasis on learning another instrument. It's, if I'm going to be a professional musician, how good do I need to be at that other instrument? Well, are people going to hire me? Do I need people to hire me on that instrument? Or do I just want to get through it for a class or because it's fun to play with my friends, right? If I want to become a university teacher, then what kinds of things do I need to know going into that? And that's going to be kind of a different set of knowledge.
Right. What about the people that go in and are like, I know I love music, but I don't know what I want to get out of it?
Well, that's a good question. I'd say that the most important thing to do is to figure out fast if the academic aspect of doing a university degree is going to be important to you. Because if you don't care about those things, there's a certain element of it that is, if I'm going to be a professional musician, maybe it's not in my best interest to go to school. Obviously, I received a lot of information that's really useful and important and matters a lot to being a good player, but the most important thing is to just practice. So maybe I don't go $40,000 in the hole and I work and I practice for 5 hours a day for 4 years. And obviously when you're in the university program, there are people who are just can just do that, where they just do the program and they can just play all the time, or they just practice all the time and they can focus and, not get burnt out. But that's not the reality for most people. And so there are going to be times when the practicing is going to suffer, or certain things are going to suffer, and or you're just going to suffer mentally through those things because you want it, or because that's just what you choose. And it's not maybe worth it for you. I mean, there were a lot of people that dropped out from my year, and a lot of people that took more than 4 years to do their degree, which is also a very common, not weird thing. A lot of my friends are doing 5 years, or there were people in the program who were doing six, because it's just a lot of classes and it's a lot of things to deal with. And that works out great for them. I mean, unlike a lot of other things, the music degree is such a personal choice of like, if my goal is not to, if I don't know that my goal is to pursue more education afterwards, then I need to figure out what things I want to get out of it and get out as fast as I can, especially if I don't want the degree. If the degree is what's important to you and you get through it, you can just get through it. And you can get information out of it that's useful. I think personally, there's no use forcing yourself through that just to get to the end and be $40,000 in debt and say, I have this piece of paper and I now hate music.
Woof, yeah. Hard truths there. I think that's pretty insightful.
I thought that was really interesting what you said about like the opportunity cost, if I heard you right, Seth, was the main opportunity cost is you're not practicing whatever your instrument of choice is or multiple instruments. And that's really, as a musician, obviously what you need to do, right? Like that's the bread and butter is practicing. I have a question, which is I've done 2 1-year master's degrees and like quite a few years apart from each other. And I would say the second master's degree, unlike the first one, I could have done it from home. But what it permitted me to do was socially, and I guess economically to some extent, was basically just take a year of my life and do solve academic or research problems that I would never otherwise be able to. How much of the value of education in your area do you think comes from having that sort of space that's granted to you, just being able to do read music theory, blah blah blah, in normal life that you would never give you 4 hours to like look at how, I don't know, whatever the musical theory aspect you're interested in would be, versus how much of it is truly the unique information you get from professors or the dynamic environment of a classroom? So is it like, is it like 100 to 0, 0 to 100, somewhere in between, and just repeat like that? Like, is it just that it gives you space to do things, or is it that there's something actually about the university experience that is actually in and of itself valuable beyond what you could do on your own?
So I think that's a bit of an interesting question, because I think it's 100% of both, if that's even a possible answer. Because really, the things that you do in a music school setting, you could do outside of a music school setting, and it's perfectly reasonable in a lot of places for that to happen. I mean, Vancouver maybe doesn't lend itself so well to that, but the way people have studied and learned kind of music that we studied and learned. I mean, jazz is a bit of a kind of a touchy word. We could talk about that later if you wanted. But jazz music, like in general, the way people have studied and learned that music forever, right, is more, it's a community thing. And so you get to learn from these people, these great people that you put yourself close to, and they have a lot of great knowledge. And also, you put yourself in a position, or you already are in a position where you can spend a lot of time and are afforded a lot of time to kind of explore these things and just be dealing with music only. And the difficulty is, depending on what kind of lifestyle you're used to, those things are harder to achieve without the university program, right? Because I could build a world for myself without the university program, where all I deal with is music things. Well, not all, but you know what I mean, as much as possible. I could also live with a lot less money and be kind of live a certain standard of living that's different, but I could deal with all those things and have that space for myself. I could also make sure that I'm going out to all the shows and meeting all the players and making, building those connections with people that way and have that access to information from this kind of deep wealth of knowledge of these people. But that would require me to make certain choices about, I'm going to go out late tonight and I'm going to spend all this time being out with these people and I'm going to deal with this and I'm going to try and get information out of these people and prove that I care about this enough to get that information, right? The university setting kind of allows for you to have both of those things. But again, there is a little bit of a barrier of like, you need to show, in order to get the most information out of the professors, you kind of need to build that personal connection a little bit. Right, you need to kind of show that you care about this or that you're going to take the information and use it the right way. You've kind of got it on the head with the two important things, but I think that neither one is more important. They're both extremely important and useful, and it's the crux of why you would go, I think, at all, really, at least for me.
Okay. I mean that does then mean that there is some value. And there's also these interaction effects, which is different than other programs, I could, to be honest. And I'd say also the thing about, this goes back if you, well, maybe Seth, I don't know if you're too young to remember the craze about MOOCs, the massive open online courses, like when these things first came out, like was it 10 years ago? And everyone's like, well, like everyone in India and Pakistan will get a Harvard level education kind of thing. And it turned out that what MOOCs were really good for was people with graduate degrees, people like myself with a master's degree, like taking another like advanced technical course on the side because you already had all of the foundation there. And so it's like, oh yeah, you already know calculus and matrix algebra. And so it was really easy. And so I wonder if the like, you talk about jazz as like an apprenticeship model. Well, like there might be other, I don't know if it's music or other disciplines where like, well, there is no apprenticeship model, and frankly, you already know a lot. And so like the value of that presence in person is limited. And something else I also experienced for myself, like the first master's degree, was I was just younger. And I think there's something about young people, 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds being together. It just has more valuable than when you're like 26 or 27. I don't know, Jared, if you agree with that, is a late bloomer in the CS space.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Like, the real biggest value I got in my theater degree was the tight-knit community that I have in learning how to build projects with my peers, right? And that was something that the theater space afforded for me. So, but then when I went back for a CS degree, I already had those skills, and really the value for my CS degree was a structured environment where I could learn to code and where I could learn math and statistics, and then eventually machine learning. So those hard skills were just a value. Yeah, I think that that's fascinating, the spin that you guys have put on this, that intersection between, I guess, your personal growth, but then bringing it to the group to then also develop with that kind of playing off of each other in your community that you need.
Yeah, I mean, the community is kind of a huge thing. You wouldn't play music in this style by yourself, really. The people do it, but the value of that is, I wouldn't say limited, because there's a lot of great solo music, but it's a community music, really. And it's all about that. It's all about the people around you. I mean, that just is the history of the music and what is the tradition and what is important about it.
Jared, maybe I can pick up on something Seth said to change the conversation of the direction a little bit, but keep it related to music, which is I think you made some throwaway line like, oh, except for Vancouver, or maybe this doesn't apply in Vancouver. And I'd love to know like what is the ideal city for someone who's passionate about pursuing a career in music, and like maybe that changes depending on the instrument or what you want to do, or if you're in a band, or big city, small city, labor market, opportunities for side income. Like what, I don't know, I'd imagine there'd be lots of factors, but I'd love to hear what they are and how Vancouver fits into this and why it's not so good.
Well, okay. I don't want to paint Vancouver in a totally negative light. I mean, the people here are great, and it's a very great community. I think that parts of what make it difficult is it's expensive to live here. Access to shows like is limited more so than in other places. I you know, it's hard for me to nail it on the head, I think, in the most accurate way, strictly because I've never really experienced the scene in another city. You know, going out, being able to go out and see lots of shows and live for cheap, quite cheap, is an important thing. I mean, one thing that Vancouver doesn't have that other cities do have a stronger, and I know they do have a stronger, is like what's called session culture. You know, when you can play music and you can play a few gigs a month and survive on that, you have a lot of free time that you would need to have a day job in Vancouver to be able to afford to live here, right? What'll happen, right, is in other cities, people will just get together to play all the time. And you know, there are people who get together to play often here, and I don't want to say that that never happens or you couldn't make that happen here. The scheduling is just tougher because people are generally, if they're playing music all the time, they're very busy and they're playing all the time. And when time do they have to, you know, because you can't just be working all the time, obviously, right? You know, you need to live your life and sleep sometimes and do things. And these people are like, if you're gonna be gigging to survive, you're gonna be playing 6 nights a week, right? Or if you're not doing that, then you likely have a day job. And then you're going to go off to rehearse or to play shows in the evening or to do other stuff. And you have a life. Like it doesn't lend itself to that. You know, I guess a piece of anecdotal evidence I could give is my drum teacher was telling me about when he was living in Montreal after he finished his degree in at McGill. It was cheap enough to live and he was making so much money. I mean, there was a lot more money, I think, in especially jazz music, but in general, for those kinds of playing things and recording sessions and stuff like that. There was so much more money. And so, you know, he could play 2 weekends worth of shows and you could pay rent and eat for a month. You know, then what do you do with all that extra time? Well, you go play with your friends or you go outside and hang out and you think about music, right? You write music, you spend your time doing that, you know, or you just live with very little. And I think that what is the opportunity to live with very little? It's not as much in this city than it is in other cities. You know, like because in Vancouver, you know, you'd think, well, I could pay rent for very cheap in a bigger city like Montreal or maybe even New York, but I live in somewhere horrible. Well, you know, how many opportunities are there to even choose to live in somewhere horrible in Vancouver at a low rent? You know, it's not as much. You know, you couldn't there's it's not urban enough throughout the city for you to be able to be like, "Oh, I'm going to just go live in this sh I have access to all these horrible rundown apartments that I could rent for cheap and just live like crap for a while." I mean, there are kind of some places where you can rent like that, but not too many. You know, you have to work for that almost. Like it's just not as common.
Right. So you like you need to minimize those hours that you're actively like monetarily productive to give yourself that space to maintain your creativity. And so you're seeing like Vancouver, because of the housing crisis mainly, it's almost like it's cutting that off.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. You also just can't eat for very cheap. There are lots of East Asian cities, right? I mean, obviously wages are a lot lower, but you can eat for like very cheap, right? I mean, you know, you ever go on vacation to an East Asian city, right? It's like, oh, I can buy lunch for myself for $2 Canadian, right? Food is also very expensive, you know, and all sorts of stuff. And if you want to drive a car, right? Or you know, maybe you need to. I mean, I play the drums. It's how do I get my stuff across the city? And lots of venues have drums, so maybe that's not the best example, but you know what I mean. It's not easy. I mean, for example, even like I had a teacher who was telling me about he was teaching at this other school like once a week, like he was doing these lessons or this like kind of group class for like a conservatory. And he said to me that he in one night a week he was making a quarter of what he was making at the university even. It's tough. Even like the university program is kind of not the best funded, which is, I mean, it's a music program, right? I don't know. Arts, fine arts, I feel like, are not high on the priority level.
Right, they're not the top 10 paid professors, that's for
No,
sure.
no, no. Not at the school, and I would be surprised if Capilano was high on the list of payroll in terms of the country, even on a per teacher basis. Because it's only really recently become a university. I think who has suffered the most has been the students in terms of that, because fees used to be a lot better. I remember talking to my my high school teacher about that when he was like, "Oh, you should go to CAP." Because when he went CAP College, it was my tuition was probably about half of what it is now. Because I pay almost the same tuition as people do at McGill, right? Or at U of T. And yeah, obviously, like Canadian tuition is a lot more generous than American tuition, but some of those American schools, you pay a crazy amount of money to go to music school. But yeah, I think that's to get back to the original point of the question. That's what separates maybe Vancouver from other cities, makes it a little tougher. The thing is too, is that the wealth of knowledge, there is a great wealth of knowledge in players in Vancouver. It's a lot more concentrated though. I mean, there are just less players, there are just less people. It's just smaller in general. It's a tighter community. You can get in with some very amazing people who know a whole lot and can teach you a lot of things. How much opportunity, right? It's the same thing, right? Scarce resources, how many people are going to have access to that realistically?
Do you think that that's is just a function of how large Vancouver is, though? Or do you think that Vancouver has a smaller community for its size as a city, even?
I think that Vancouver, yes, has a smaller population. We also have kind of like what is the general pop public is the, how receptive is the general public to going out and seeing like live music? You know, I would say probably like not very compared to other places. You know, what is like the propensity for people to be out at night at all just to kind of party and want to meet other people and like have it's a pretty insular place to live in. People don't talk on the bus. People don't you don't talk with other people at restaurants. You know, I went out drinking with a friend the other day, and I was pleasantly surprised that some guy had come in to and wanted to chat with us at the bar. But he wasn't from Vancouver, right? Like that only happened because he was kind of not privy to the culture necessarily of that, because that wouldn't happen otherwise. It just doesn't happen in the city as
Yeah,
much.
I can't say that I remember a time that a stranger has talked to me at a bar in Toronto either, though. It might be a wider problem than that, but
Maybe.
I think Ontarians are much more, I don't know, social, but at least like in a networking sense. Like I remember like the universities here, like there was just a lot more, especially when it came to like dating and courtship, there was just this sense of like people just kind of, this is going to be a weird way of phrasing it, but them throwing themselves at other at random people, like this, which is what you just do. And it was okay to be like very forward. I mean, obviously there's like other issues that are associated with that, but just like, I do think the, and especially like in kind of the business kind of community here sense, I just get the sense that people are, especially people that have like they're from Ontario, like they're really from Ontario. They probably haven't even left the province. I think they tend to be quite gregarious. They tend to have almost like an American streak to themselves, I'd say.
I stand corrected for sure.
It's just my feeling, but so Seth, I know you don't want to like throw shade at Vancouver. So what's been like a dream city, like cheap artist flat, people who want to chat to you at bars, like give good tips at the end of shows. Like what are some like dream cities in your mind for jazz or otherwise?
I guess I can't speak to the living conditions because I don't strictly know, but obviously, if you went to, you know, New York is the place with the best players. It's just the way it is. It'll always, I mean, it always has, and it probably always will have the best players. If you wanted to go somewhere, it's very fast-paced living though, and from what I've heard from folks I know who have been out there, if you wanted to surround yourself with the best people, I mean, it's also they're a lot more intense. Like, you know, someone in Vancouver, people in Vancouver won't cut you. If you're if aware of that kind of phrase, turn of phrase, as in like they won't they're a little more polite, you know, if someone's on stage or the kinds of comments you get from people afterwards won't be as mean despite, you know, they might think, oh, that was not good, or you need to deal with this thing, or you don't have that together.
Is that a good thing though? Like sometimes it's better to rip the band-aid off, or do you think that that's not? I guess it maybe it depends on who
Six,
you are as a person.
yeah, six one half dozen another, I think. I mean, if it if you need that to be motivated, or if you need that as feedback, that's very good. I mean, there's a reason also though why the level of play is so much higher in other places like that. I think in general, like you know, I don't think that the floor is any different, and we have some very good players. But I think that yeah, it depends on the person, depends on kind of what you're like. I think that it's more direct. I mean, you get more done that way. But you do run the risk of, obviously, like anything else, you run the risk of sending someone away who maybe they just needed a softer touch to kind of deal with these things. But if you want to get straight down to the brass tacks, I mean, it's better that way.
What about a city like Chicago, Seth? Is that how close would that be to like New York?
I'm sure it's a great scene there. I mean, a lot of the major US cities are bigger. They have more players. More people kind of come through town because a lot of the best players live and work and are Americans. And not all, but 90% easily of the most important figures in this kind of music, right? Like are Americans. And then probably a lot of the rest of them are like Canadians. Like it's, you're going to be in North America pretty well. I mean, and not to say that there isn't like a high level of play in other parts of the world, but it's not really the same. And you're not really exposed to it as much because people who are Americans, they tour continental America. So they're hitting all these major cities all the time. So somewhere like Chicago, right? Or like I mean, Philadelphia is a place with a lot of amazing players who have been born there and lived there and things like that. But all those kinds of major Eastern cities, I mean, Western cities too. I think LA is a little bit of a different thing. But a lot of good players will come through there, so you'll be exposed to a lot of good music. You'll be able to meet these people and talk to them, and they're generally pretty friendly. I mean, what it means to be a celebrity, I think, of, American art music is like you're not really a celebrity, so these people are pretty accessible sometimes.
So I think I'm starting to get a sense of like the jazz industry as a whole here. But like the one thing that I think I'm missing from this is this like, what are these positions that these guys that make up the like best players? Like, what do they do? Or is it just like word of mouth and people just like know their names and they play all the clubs? Or is there like how do you know that you're one of the guys once in a city, you know?
Well, you're one of the guys when the other guys say you are, basically. I mean, for better or for worse. I mean, that's kind of the way it is. I mean, you can kind of tell by listening to someone, and if you have a good ear, it's what people who know think, really. It's tough because in the public eye, what is perceived as quote unquote jazz music or is wide. Extremely wide and much wider than what I think, someone who's in a quote unquote jazz program would mean by that. And so, who are the great players? Well, there are people who play well, and other people acknowledge that they play well, and they've played with other people who are at the high level, at that high level.
I guess I'm trying to relate it to like other high level music art forms, like classical music, maybe, where it's like there are these institutions that kind of support like the symphony, or there's, you know, the set of funders that like puts the money into that, and then they pick, like, you know, you become the conductor for the New York Philharmonic, and then, you know, you're in like that role, and there's that institutional grounding that kind of people play in and whatnot. Is there like a similar thing to that with jazz that like I'm just oblivious to, or how to what underpins it, I guess?
Not really anything. I mean, probably someone would tell me I'm full of shit, but there are big organizations that are funding music, jazz music, right? You think about like Lincoln Center, something like that, right? They have the jazz band and they play and they have lots of people come through and a guest artist for those kinds of things. But it's not the same. It's a lot more individualistic. It's more individualistic, kind of all the way up and down. Like it is and it isn't. So when you're a great technical player and you can play all the excerpts and you know the pieces, the classical music pieces, right? You can become first chair violin and a philharmonic, and that's like a job, and you can play and make a living and those kinds of things. But that doesn't really, it's not the same thing, because it's not all about, but it's a lot about artistry. More so, like individual kind of artistry in terms of jazz music. And so there are things you're expected to know, like a classical musician is, and to be able to play. And of course, like playing in a style or in the idiom of something is important, but it's improvised music, right? So it kind of comes down to this person, right? Or that person. then it's kind of up to taste a little bit about whether or not people like what you're doing. But often you're a good player if you're kind of connected to a sort of lineage of music, of the music in some facet.
Sorry, what do you mean? Can you expand a bit on that? Like lineage of the music? I'm not sure.
So the thing about it is there are a lot of different ways kind of improvising or to deal with that. Do you want to get really into it? We can get really into it right now. Right into the ground level of it, if
I
that's.
mean, we're a bit off the question script for this podcast episode, but I'm enjoying getting into the depths of jazz. So
Okay.
I say take it away, Seth.
Okay. So, I mean, how much do you have a lot of music background, Eric?
I know a lot about the classical jazz, like from like I'm trying to think where does my knowledge start? Like maybe the early 1950s to about the 1970s would be my knowledge of jazz.
Well, that's pretty wide. Okay.
Okay,
The
if early
thing.
miles to late miles kind of thing, if that helps.
Okay. So the thing about it in terms of improvising, there are certain ways to play over chord changes. There are certain kinds of chord scales you use. There are certain kind of notes. There's a large element of what's like quoting, right? Because how many different ways to play 12 notes are there? But you kind of say it's like a language, right? You pick up words and phrases that people say on the instrument, and you use them, and maybe you come up with your own. Well, not maybe you do. You come up with things that are your own that are kind of attached to those things. But jazz music, it kind of all comes from a sim that's the same place, but the approach splinters, right? And there are kind of certain schools of thought about improvising and about different ways to play. And so people today are connected to various different sections of the music that they're interested in, that they like. That's often through the players, right, that they like. So if I said, what's a good example? Oh, I really like Kenny Garrett, for example, a saxophone player. Well, Kenny Garrett really liked John Coltrane. And he plays some stuff that John Coltrane played, and he's kind of into that later John Coltrane kind of style of playing. Well, I can go back and I can deal with the things that Kenny Garrett's playing on the saxophone. I can deal then with some of the things that he's taken away from Coltrane. And maybe if I want to figure out how Train kind of got to that, I could deal with things that Coltrane was dealing with earlier. And well, that leads me down, I could get into Coleman Hawkins, and I could listen to, and that's like in the 40s, right? Like I could listen to Coleman Hawkins, and I could deal with the things that he was doing and play the way he was playing. And that's kind of like a connecting thread all the way up into the present, right? You can imagine there's a lot of those. There's a lot of different players. And there are a lot of different kind of, what's the word for this? Like, not touchstone, but waypoints, kind of people who act as waypoints in between certain styles. I mean, Miles is a interesting example because he's played in a lot of different ways, and there are people who get into Miles Davis. If you just dealt with Miles Davis in the 60s, for example, with the Second Great Quintet, if you just dealt with that way of playing only, you could do a whole lot with that, and you could go off into a different direction, maybe. I mean, it's pretty specific, and you will never end up playing like Miles. But this is kind of my point, right? Like, if you get to a point where people in the modern day, you can have two people who play the saxophone very differently, and they're still playing like jazz music because of their connection through this kind of great tree. They're out on different arms of the tree, but they're still kind of connected to the branch in a certain way. For you to say who are the guys, well, if I like this branch of the tree, I'm going to deal with those guys, and I'm going to think those guys are the greatest, and I'm going to go out there and listen to them. That doesn't mean I don't think that people on the other branch are great or necessarily, but I'm not going to be dealing with those people as much strictly, right?
So this is why you had a jazz history class in your first year.
Yeah, but often people don't deal with it that way. Right? It's just like a class, and you're just sitting there, and it was a pretty dry class. But this is like the importance, the historical aspect of it is extremely important to know what the people you're listening to, what they listen to, and what those people were listening to. And not only that, but you have a certain obligation, especially as someone, it's black music, right? It's black American music. For someone who's culturally outside of that in an infinite number of ways, being, a white and Asian kid from Vancouver, Canada. Like, it's an important aspect of being honest about about the art form, right? And being honest about, oh, I know who this person was and what their life was like. Because it's important to remember those things and to keep those things going for not just the music's sake, but in order to be kind of honest.
But like the culture of jazz too.
The culture of the music, yeah.
I was just Googling it, and because like if you know jazz, you know that like especially like with like Blue Note and Columbia, these like famous recordings, all of these artists were like in each other's groups or bands or posses. I don't know what exactly you call it, like the quintets or whatever, right? So like
Yeah.
Miles Davis has a quintet, but then like Cannonball Adderley like hived off and started his own group or whatever. And there are some like pretty cool, I was just Googling it, some really cool like network maps showing like especially like even contemporary jazz artists how they trace their I don't know if the right to borrow from genetics if you know Jared like would phylogenetic trees or phylogeny be the right way of phrasing it, but you could do that. Yeah.
That's funny, yeah. Yeah, that's it's totally a good thing to do. And I mean, some people, it's funny, there are some players who, well, not too many, I guess. Probably nobody will achieve this either, but you know, someone like Wynton Marsalis, you might be aware of. He did something in like the 90s. He did stuff that changed totally a whole course of music. That album Black Coats from the Underground, and there's lots of other good records in there you could find. But he changed like the whole course of music, and the way he's playing on those records is totally new. It's totally fresh. Like he stood at the edge of the new thing. Not the new thing. Anyways, doesn't matter. Of this new thing. But he decided later on that that was not what he wanted anymore. So he doesn't really. I mean, it's not that he couldn't, but he doesn't choose to play those things anymore. He plays in a different way now. That's more connected to New Orleans and pops and players like that.
Yeah, although Wynton Marsalis has to be kind of an exception to the usual jazz. I mean, he started as a classical trumpeter, right? Didn't or did I don't know, at least I have some al I have some old records of him like playing like Bach or something. Alboni trumpet concertos, I think.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is kind of an interesting thing. You want to get into the history of this, but he, as well as a lot of more than a few other players, like wanted to be classical musicians, really. Like someone like Herbie Hancock wanted to be a classical pianist, but he wasn't allowed into that space because he was black. They didn't, you know, he was set to play. Oh man, I'm gonna mess this up. The history, exact history of this, but basically, you know, he was set to play with some big orchestra when he was like a young kid, and the conductor didn't want him to play, even though he was this amazing piano player, because he didn't want a little black kid sitting at the piano in front of the orchestra. In the, you know, this was in like the 40s and 50s, right? Like this is in the 50s. He's born in the 40s, but a lot of those guys have a great understanding. So we get into like the academia of it. A big part of why jazz academia can exist is because of this connection to classical music. And someone like Wynton, yeah, he's a bit of an exception, maybe, but in that way, he is an exception, extreme exception in terms of his technical ability. Like he's an amazing trumpet player, but he didn't. I don't think he. I don't have the information for sure on whether he started that way. But yeah, he had an extensive thing as a classical player. But I just think that that space was just not open for him at the time.
So I do want to end, as usual, our podcast with some underrated versus overrated. So I'm going to steal one of my underrated, overrated questions for this, which is like the opening scene of the movie La La Land. Have you seen that movie?
I have not seen it.
Oh, okay.
I
Well,
couldn't bring myself to
that.
because you know, have you seen Whiplash?
Yeah. Oh, that was another question in my underrated, overrated. So let's get them over with now. All right. Give me
Okay.
your Whiplash thoughts.
I think it's a sports movie. This is like an Adam Neely opinion, which I think is very good because I saw that movie and I really didn't like it for some reasons. I mean, it's a fine movie, but it's pretty silly. Like those things would never happen in that way. And the kind of over dramatization of a lot of those things, right? Like, you know, you couldn't play the drums hard enough that you bled without like the sticks being pointy. You know what I mean? Like your arm would freeze before you did that, before you cut yourself open. But like, it's kind of stuff like that, right? Like, it's just he's playing really hard and practicing as hard as he can, and you know, the whole character of what's the name of the what's Fletcher, the teacher, whatever, that's kind of silly. It's overblown, and I don't know. The whole movie, I think that the movie paints maybe music school and music education in a certain way, and I don't know that I agree with it or like it. It paints it in a certain perspective of being intense and difficult, and you need to work hard at it, which is true. But I think that it gives too much credence, or not credence, it places too much value in the idea of the institution being an important part of that.
I'm going to say that you think the movie is overrated.
Overrated. Yeah, sorry. I should have just gone with that.
Well, okay. Try this on for a sec. So, like, the opening scene of La La Land is
Okay.
Ryan Gosling's character is in a car, like, on in like some endless traffic jam on one of the LA highways, and he just keeps rewinding this like 5 seconds piano opening. I don't even remember if it was like a real jazz musician, but basically this is like the stereotype of the someone who's obsessed about like nailing like a piano solo from like some 1960s session or something like that. I think is what the implication of what was like. How is that a parody, or is there like how truthful is it? Is it 1% truthful or like 50% truthful?
It's, I mean, is he trying to play that at the gig? What's on the record?
Well, he yeah, I mean, there is a club that he goes to, but I think he's just obsessed with this like this one jazz artist. I can't remember if it was fictional or not, but
Oh, it's pretty accurate then. I mean, if, like the act of transcription is like paramount. I'd say maybe, I mean, I haven't seen the scene. Maybe 80 or 90. Yeah.
you should watch the movie, and then we can clarify and rate it
Then
or
we can
overrated.
clarify. We can reconvene
Yeah.
on La La Land. We'll have
In
our
a movie
first
about
follow-up.
jazz and about acting, like those are the two artistic careers that the movie is basically about. In terms of, I mean, there's other themes in the movie as well, but like in terms of the fine arts career path, those are the two things that it focuses on. So I feel like, you got to watch it at least then to be able to like shoot it down in case it's
Oh,
because a
that's
lot of
true.
people use it as a reference point. I mean, I use it so.
Well, I mean, if it's any help to you, from in my experience, from what people have said to me, is that they enjoyed La La Land more than Whiplash. A lot of my friends don't like that movie, or they enjoyed it as a movie, but the themes of it, I guess the themes of it just didn't frustrate them as much as it frustrated me, I think, watching it. I think that a lot of them said they enjoyed La La Land more for a variety of reasons.
All right, that's good. I think we have a partial answer for underrated, overrated for that one.
Underrated, partial
So,
answer. Right in the middle, maybe, from me?
accurately rated. So Seth, you are a Gen Zer. I'm 90% sure.
Yes.
I know because you can't be a millennial and you're not Gen Alpha because my daughter is Gen Alpha and I don't. I mean, yeah, but so I just don't.
No.
You don't seem young enough.
2001 is, I think, Gen Z.
Okay. Now, in terms of the millennial experience, Jared and I feel like we feel it every day. I don't know about you, but like being a millennial, or at least contrasting my generation to others, is very much a part of like my core identity at this point in my life, especially as like things become harder and you have to make more like tough family decisions and blah, blah, blah. I'm curious, how do you, at a high level, just feel your generational status? Is it at all relevant to your identity? Do you muse about these things? Do you think of yourself compared to millennials or boomers or Gen Alpha? So any thoughts on that, I'd love to hear.
To me, I think it's just a fun joke. It's just fun because I think a lot of my friends know how much it bothers people who are millennials, so it's fun to poke fun at I mean, at least for me, for sure, it's a lot of fun to poke fun at my sister.
That's
How
funny
about
because
that?
that's the such a Gen Z response. The irreverence, it just drips with irreverence, and that is a classic.
There you go.
Okay,
You have your answer.
but let me be okay, I gave you a lot of leeway to answer that question. So now I'm gonna like hone in on the way I actually wanted you to answer it, which is basically, do you have an antagonistic feeling towards boomers in general?
I think yes and no. I think that there are certain. Okay, I think it's tough. I think it's tough. And maybe this is just because of the way I think about things. But I think yes, I disagree with a lot of things that are as a result of the way it was before and like the good old days and keeping the ship moving forwards. And I think that it would be great if, like, I guess socially and politically and all sorts of stuff, economically, those things are bother me. And I do feel bothered by the fact that, as a cohort, Gen Z, right, in terms of the voting power, I mean, it's going to get bigger, I guess, but it'll never be It'll never be that big in comparison. But at the same time, I kind of feel like, people are only really going to be able to do what they can do. And for people who have been living a certain way for so long, at a certain point, obviously there comes a point where you got to stick to your guns and say no. But at a certain point, like, how much can you expect people to change?
The one thing I was thinking is like, well, like up until this moment, which is, millennials have it hard, but obviously Gen Z is going to have it even harder, like vis-a-vis like jobs and housing. But the one thing that's different, which is that like the thing that millennials hate hearing is like, oh, well, you'll inherit all of the boomer wealth when they die. And it's like, yeah, but like we'll be on average between the ages of 50 to 70, right? Like, so we'll be at retirement age, right? So that's not particularly useful for us now. But Gen Z actually could inherit the boomer wealth at a slightly more useful time in their lives, because I thought about my daughter Sienna, and like, well, like by the time she's a reasonable age, like where she needs to make these like harder geography or life decisions, like for sure her grandparents, most of them I don't imagine will be living, but Gen Z is somewhere in the middle, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that those things don't bother me so much. And maybe my friends, because I've maybe, well, yeah, I'll paraphrase, probably my friends. But for me, for sure, I think, like, the way I imagine things going is that the world is going to change so much when that large cohort of people dies. You know what I mean? And things are going to be so different. I think that things are going to break apart so much that it won't matter for me to inherit a large, vast amount of wealth. Like, there are going to be
That's
other things
fair.
that are more important.
But like, will it matter that much for Gen Z? Because like, what's the probability that a Gen Z has no older relative in the line between them and a boomer? That's like a Gen X or a millennial, right? I
Well,
feel like
my.
they're just not gonna, it's not gonna trickle down that far for most,
No.
for the vast majority of that generation, you know?
To be totally frank, I think a lot of my future kind of rests in your hands. Like, I kind of feel that way about it. I guess it's this indifference you talk about, right? But I think that I'm going to try and, I care about the things that I care about, and I want to try and make the world better, obviously. But at the same time, there's only so much that I can do, That's how I feel about it. And I feel like a lot of it comes down to what the millennials decide to do and people of Gen X decide to do when they start to get into the age,
So I want to have one last crack at getting one more level deep, which is that like, some of these things that we've talked about already, like you can't be a starving artist literally in Vancouver. It's off the table. There are so many things you could imagine, like university is just way more expensive than it used to be. Like these aren't random phenomena of, nature. They're not like solar eclipses or, solar flares. Like these are policy decisions that have been, in my view, overwhelmingly decided by the boomers. Okay, I'm gonna give you the negative take on boomers. Okay. And tell me how much of this resonates with you or if you think about this. And when boomers were of our age, they made sure that they cleared every obstacle out of their way. And so we built tremendous amounts of highways and schools and things were cheap and, and then when they started working, they got lots of good benefits and blah, blah, blah. And then at a certain point, they said, you know what? We're going to be pulling up the ladder. So we're actually going to stop building houses. We're going to start raising the price of school, right? We're going to make it harder for people to move between cities to get jobs like the way we did. In other words, like, do you have any angst like in the way that I'm projecting right now that the ladder has been pulled up by the previous generation at all for you?
No. I think that it just makes me sad. It just, like, the thing about it, like, to me, it's just a projection of human nature. This is just how people are and what people will do, like, as a group, because they make people, people want things to stay the way that they want, and they get what they want, and they go, ah, I have this now. This is mine. Right? And like, I don't think it's fair for me to be that upset, because I think that there's nothing really special about my generation in terms of, would we do the same thing? Probably. I mean, if things start to get cheap again, I think it's unlikely that people devalue things like detached housing and having space and suburb living and standards of life that directly improve their kind of quality of living, but who cares about other people, really? It's maybe very negative. I think I have a very negative kind of worldview, which insulates me from this direct angst at boomers. Maybe.
Everyone's in the gutter, so why hate any specific generation?
Yeah, it just all sucks. I think that's just what it is. It just all sucks.
I guess this is going to be just kind of an awkward transition because I still want to get this topic in at the end, just because it's pretty relevant to me and Eric's jobs, and I think it's like just in the news so much right now. But it's for the context for our listeners. I shared with Seth and Eric earlier on some examples on GitHub from this Music LM, which is basically an AI, generative AI model for creating music. And we've all kind of listened to it. And Seth, trained jazz musician expert that we've brought on the show here, we want to get the real take on this music. And like, are people outside of the AI community even talking about AI that much? Are there concerns? Do people think that it's baloney? And then what's your take on these actually generated clips? And do you th where do you think this what this means for the industry? I mean, that was a lot.
Generated, I don't think generated music is a problem the way that it has been, like generated text has been for people, or they make it out to seem like it's changing the world and it's going to be horrible, or even generated images. Like I think the nature of music doesn't lend itself to AI generation being exploitable, if that makes sense. Like yes, I think in some capacity, maybe in a commercial sense, but already a lot of the music that I like is extremely uncommercial already. And most people in my space, and also listening to your examples, I mean the swing and the jazz ones, they were easily the worst. It was like
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I do remember, like, there was an example that I was like, this is supposed to have Gregorian chants in it. And I was like, there's not even vocals in this.
yeah.
So it was pretty lackluster. I mean, to me, it was impressive in the fact that before this, if you wanted a computer to generate music, it literally would produce nothing, right? So the
Yeah.
fact that it can go from a sentence to something that, like, a 5-year-old could bang out on the piano is like a monumental leap. Right. But obviously, it's got a long way to go.
Yeah, I think for sure. And I think that the idea of the craft of music making is separate from other art forms, in that other art forms, people look at the product, right? And people want just the product. And in music, kind of people do too. I mean, we have streaming services where people pay like literally no money and just have access to music. I mean, I do too. I'm not saying like there's anything about the individual at the individual level that's like morally corrupt so bad. Anyways, but people pay a lot of money to see people play music live still. And I think that that won't go away because of that's the aspect. I want to have the visual and the auditory element. And I think that a big part of that is like the human aspect, right? There are robots that, and people, there are big machines people have made to make music, and people like that. But it's still relatively niche compared to the live music aspect, right? More people are still going to go watch Beyonce on this, I don't know how much you follow that, but on her current world tour singing. More people are going to go watch that because it's a spectacle, and because like she and the people around her actually are the spectacle and the product themselves as people. And it's the same, I think, in classical music and jazz music too, right? The people are the spectacle. And so you couldn't take the people out of that and have a product anymore.
Right. So I guess to kind of simplify it, because I see there's like two ways of automation kind of replacing people. There's like the way that, factory work kind of replaced all tailors, basically. And so like the clothing industry is gone. Or there's like, I guess chess is maybe a better example now, where, computers are better than any human will ever be at chess. Yet so many people still play chess and still revere these grandmasters who play it as humans. I guess you're in the music's going to be chess because people appreciate humans doing what humans do at their limits.
Yeah, and because you can write a piece of music. Like, here's the thing, right? Like those prompts, like listening, some of them are pretty good. Like the pieces of music that the AI generates on the prompt in terms of style and feeling and like, you know, obviously it doesn't quite have imitating acoustic instruments just yet, but that's probably only a matter of time. The thing about it is people want to know, I think, I could be wrong, but at least for me and the people around me, people want to know that there's an honest intention behind the message of a song, right? Or behind those kinds of things, right? Or behind the feeling, right? That there is somebody who listened to this and thought, this encapsulates how I'm feeling about a certain situation or about how I'm experiencing the world around me. And I think that's part of the marketability of it. So something like chess, right? You have like a chess AI that's like the best at chess, better than anybody. Music doesn't have a best or like an end goal that way, right? I think it would be very hard to determine what people think is the best. And you could have an AI that would spit out great popular music, probably, you know, that people would listen to and go, this is fine. Being an art musician already, I'm kind of already outside of that. You could just spit out music. You know, you could, and you go to music school and you learn about people like Bach, right? You could just spit out a ton of music that's like the music that he made. I mean, kind of not really, because it's hard to do that, but you could learn how to do it, and there are people that just spit out music like that, right? And you can make it super formulaic, and you can, you know, these are what the chord changes are, and this is like a in the style of we're going to this key now, and we're going to use this progression, and then these are the melodies that you can generate over top of this, right? Like there's so many, you know, if you pick a subdivision, you go, oh, I'm making a melody over C major, and I'm doing it in eighth notes in a bar of 4/4. Like, how many different ways can you make C major happen? There's only so many. I mean, there's a lot, but there's only so many. So you could spit out a ton of music like that, but it doesn't have the element of the human element. I don't think that. I think that we're already so far outside of that in terms of art music that it just people wouldn't get onto it. I
Right.
mean,
So it's like, what do you think makes Taylor Swift so popular? And it's not her songs. It's who Taylor Swift is.
well, part of it's the songs. I wouldn't say that none of it's the songs, but I think that you get to a point, you could get to a point conceivably where no matter how good the AI gets at making the songs, the AI doesn't make Taylor Swift. I mean, maybe like it could on some level, but I think that's like some kind of crazy dystopian future where we're like totally fabricating these personalities of people with AI and like, I don't know, worshiping them. Like it's crazy.
Right, we're not quite there yet. Yeah,
We're
like
not even
we
close.
need
Like,
music LM to also have a social media account, fabricate a backstory, have a million
yeah.
ex-boyfriends, et
Go
cetera, et
out and,
cetera.
yeah, exactly. Go out and meet fans and like deal with social issues the way that the music LM would. You know, like it's just people like One Direction because they, you know, little girls love the idea of these like five attractive men singing these love songs, right? I don't know. I mean, lots of other people do. That's not the only demographic, but you get what I'm getting at, I think.
No, I think so.
God, it was pretty cool though. Some of those were like pretty good. I think the electronic examples where it was able to more accurately generate what that sounds like made by people, those were way better. And some of those were pretty good.
I actually quite liked some of the paintings to text to music. For some reason, those kind of resonated with me. Like they had a similar vibe to the paintings, the music did. I don't know why, but there was that was kind of weird. It
It was,
seemed
yeah.
like it captured some kind of anyway.
It knows some stuff. I mean, I didn't get to the real nitty-gritty of like reading all the stuff about it. But I mean, at the same time, the part of that's like human input, right? Like someone has put in what this painting kind of evokes, and other people have gone and tagged music, right? Like I would bet that that would be a much less resonant experience for someone like an Indonesian, for example, because this is a whole other thing, but there's like something you learn about when you start to learn about other kinds of music in the world, which is like often, I mean, all music is kind of built upon the same fundamental structure of like sound, obviously, but what certain sounds mean is so different in different cultures. So I guess, you know, what's the vibe of a painting based on color and imagery to someone in a different culture would be so different, and then how does that relate to a piece of music would also be extremely different for that person, right? Like, what is dissonance? What is consonance? What is a normal progression? What's a normal time feel? I think that was like one thing. This is a bit of a tangent, but that was one thing that I thought was interesting that the AI kind of fumbled in a lot of the examples, especially that one that was it took the melody and then it didn't different styles. It fumbled the time. It wasn't able to put it into the same meter, actually, which I thought was interesting. It fumbled in kind of similar places in some of those examples, but it like would drop a beat or things like that. I don't know. That's probably just a quirk of the technology, but
No, I mean, you're probably picking up on a pattern that it's failing to do. Yeah. You raise an interesting point there too, of like listening to all of these AI generated things, and maybe it's just specific to music, but we are bringing our own cultural biases to all of these things too, I guess, when it comes to these generative things. It could be that they are overfit somewhat to just our own personal impressions. And that's not necessarily that. I mean, they could probably replicate it then maybe for other cultures, but to be able to be globally generalizable, multitask even.
that's kind of a big part of North American music, especially American music, right? Is this kind of combination of things in terms of jazz music, like Western harmony kind of things and access to Western instruments, so like Western tunings and things like that, and like African rhythmic tradition. I would be interested. I bet you could train an AI to do that. But like, I don't know, at this point, it would be really difficult, right? Like, it would be, you'd have to spend all this time they spend on Music LM to do a different culture to really like get it. And then in order to combine those things in a really honest way or in a new way, I think people are just faster at that sort of thing. Maybe right now, things probably change. And maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know as much about it as either of you do.
I mean, I guess technically music is discrete in the way I assume Music LM writes discrete like notes and specific time signatures, but like in practice, I think it's probably more continuous, whereas like words are more discrete in the sense of that like there is like it can pr if I'm thinking like ChatGPT produces a paragraph, like sure, like maybe it could have been written better, but like functionally, it is a correct paragraph for the path that you could just send it as a reply and it would be fine. With music, there might be these like last mile problems that are just inevitable because of like the sort of continuous nature of the sound and blah blah blah. I'm like, yeah, you can be like, wow, this is like the chorus, and then you can break it up. But I find like maybe it's just there's just going to be a little bit more of the this cyborg requirement to the cyborg being like a human AI fusion than there is for just like a language type model one. But I mean, we'll see. I mean, like, I think, have you used ChatGPT in some of these like open
Yeah,
source language models?
I've used ChatGPT a fair
Yeah.
amount now.
So like, let's say that it could produce music at a ChatGPT like level of producing the English language. Would any of your answers change, do you think?
It's interesting. It would be that's hard. That's hard to me because I think of the what how that would translate. I'm not totally sure about that. I think at least in my experience with it, like ChatGPT, well, because it's pretty human passing. I mean, I think that the idea of like live music would probably still exist. I mean, recorded music and what's like popular music would probably change still. But I think even in today's day and age, people are starting, especially the younger generations, like people in my generation, people value live music much more, right? Especially you get all these vast kind of libraries of music online you can get for cheap. Recorded music is dead, but live music is still does well. People still make money doing that, and people still want to pay to do that and experience live music, right? And I think it's still a little bit cold and unfeeling. I mean, maybe if you could, yeah, I don't know, you'd still need someone to get on stage and say what the algorithm has given you, right? So I think it's like an interesting proposition there. Yeah, maybe it would change. I think it was interesting what you were saying about continuity, though, because I think especially rhythm, which was something that it kind of fell over with, is something that's extremely continuous. You look at like the phenomenon of music production in the 90s with like the J Dilla kind of beats, where it's like it's a little bit wrong, quote unquote, like it's a little bit off, and people want that sound, where it's like a little bit not in time, right? Or like things like Caribbean music, like things with like a clave, like Cuban music, the rhythmic feel sits in between two kind of discrete Western zones, like what we'd like to describe as like six and four. The rhythmic feel is kind of in between those and goes between them very fluidly in a way that I you would struggle with, I think. But I don't know. Anyways, to get back to your actual question, I think, yeah, the answers would probably change a little bit. Not so much, though.
All right,
Underrated,
so
overrated.
Seth, as usual, we like to end on an underrated versus overrated. We got a glimpse of it before for the movies that you have and haven't seen, but basically, feel free to pass on questions you either don't want to answer or, you don't have, maybe you haven't heard of it before. And you're welcome just to say underrated, overrated, or give a short detail as to why you think it is. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. West Coast Jazz.
Right in the middle. Right in the middle. It's good. It's good. I think what it's kind of spawned in terms of what people think is jazz, like the whole Kenny G phenomenon, overrated. That's bad. West Coast jazz itself, not bad. It's good.
The band Snarky Puppy.
I'm gonna go with under. I like Snarky Puppy. I think they get too much flack. I think it's good music.
All right. Gap Years.
Underrated.
All right. Do you want to give a bit of an explanation?
I think that generally people perceive it as bad and not good and you're maybe wasting time. I think it's, at least in my experience in kind of the West here, or like the way people talk about it, oh, you should go straight to university, or you should go straight into the next thing. In my experience, people I know who've done it generally enjoyed it and don't regret it. Probably a good thing.
All right, fair enough. Moving to geography, more local interests for you. The city or area of Steveston.
Overrated.
You want to say a few words there?
Steveston's cool. It's cool to visit a couple times. It's not its own. It's not. People treat it like it's its own city. It's not a. It's not a. It's Richmond. I think people. They think they're too cool. They think they're too good for us in the rest of Richmond.
Like a true non-Stevestonian.
Yeah, for sure.
Got a little South Surrey thing going on. It's not a real city. All right, maybe you know these places, maybe you don't. Deer Lake Park.
I'm gonna go with underrated. I didn't know about that area before. I live a lot closer to it now than I did when I was a kid. It's a pretty cool spot.
Yeah, it's an area just north of Metro Town, which is a
Yeah.
large kind of shopping center, SkyTrain station in the Lower
Yeah.
Mainland.
Oh,
Yeah.
sorry for
All
the
right,
thing.
last one, the Evergreen Line.
Underrated. I think it's good. I think it's good we do transit to places that don't have transit right now. And I'm upset that they didn't extend the Broadway line all the way out to UBC because it means there still needs to be buses. And I think that's bad. Evergreen line, very good. Underrated.
Actually, I think Evergreen Line prompted one more question for you. Seth, when I lived in the Lower Mainland, I really wanted Coquitlam to be like in a shorthand term called Coco, because you've got Poco, Parker Coquitlam, you've got many cities in the world like NoHo, Soho. I know it doesn't work perfectly, but do you think we need more like two syllabic short like expressions? I feel like Coco could get us going, but maybe it's just a bridge too far for Coquitlam.
I like that idea. I think it's too late though. Now with the movie, it's too late. Disney's got that one, man. It's
Oh, do they? Okay.
gone.
I'm not up to date. I'm sorry. Do you want to add any?
Haven't seen Coco?
I don't even know what it refers to, so no.
Oh, it was a pretty good movie. You
Okay.
might, if
Well, here's
you
the
like
thing. I'll go
Disney
watch.
animation.
Yeah, I'll go watch La La Land. You can go watch Coco.
All right, I'm looking it up right now.
Okay.
Oh, this one. Oh, I think I actually have a very negative sentiment about this movie because if I'm not mistaken, it robbed that Van Gogh animated painting movie with like a lot of like eight Hollywood eight actors, like was gonna win all the stuff at the Oscars or whatever, and then this movie just robbed it of the chance and won all of like the animated awards that year instead. So although I know nothing about it other than the short clips of why this movie didn't win more awards was because of this one, Coco.
Okay, I think that's fair because I don't think the movie's that good. It's good. It's not like a bad movie, but is it record break? Is it groundbreaking? I don't know. Maybe also it just wasn't culturally resonant enough for me personally to feel that way. But
so underrated, overrated, Jagmeet Singh.
Both? Can I go with both? I think certain aspects overrated. Other aspects underrated. I think that I hate the friggin' the Instagram thing. That's just like a personal gripe. I hate that he's making himself into this friggin' influencer politician. But I like that he has opinions about things and cares about them strongly, and that those opinions are generally positive and inclusive for most people, like, you know, for people. And
that's good feedback for him. You're his target audience, I think. So, you know.
I remember I saw this. This is an aside. I remember I saw this really stupid video of him like riding like one of those electric longboards. You know, the ones with the remote and you can speed up and slow down. Have you never seen that? Do you know what I'm
vaguely,
talking about?
Vaguely, but I didn't know it was really a big thing.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. I just remember I saw a video of him doing that on TikTok and he was like, oh, look at me on the skateboard. Like, I'm cool. And I was like, this is stupid, man.
Stay like, in fair your play. Lane. Talk
fair
politics.
Play. You know, I don't know.
This one's maybe more general, but we were talking about the Evergreen Line. So I wanted to say urbanism.
Underrated. I think it's good. I think bigger cities are better for people. I think that being close and being dense is better for people in a lot of ways. Like in terms of our society now, I think it's a good thing.
All right, fair enough.
I mean, I agree with you, Seth, but I feel like we'd have to go back and revise the answer about the boomers, because the reason you don't have that is because of them. So, I mean, like, you know.
That's true. Oof. That's true. Well, but here's the thing, though. We don't have urbanism because people want to have their cake and eat it, too. You can't have it all. You can't live in the bush and have all the nice things about living in the bush and live in the city, but that's what suburban life is supposed to be. And I think that you should just choose one. At a certain point, you know, you gotta jump in the pool. You know, you're either gonna live out in the bush and have all the implicated things, or you're gonna live in the city.
No. People want a subway line by their single family detached home. That's literally what happens in Toronto. But Seth, I'll just say, you know, you can, without loss of accuracy, replace the word people with boomers, and it's more accurate.
Yeah, that's
just.
I think that's
trying
fair.
To drop up some intergenerational conflict here.
Oh man, this episode 17, the generational wars. That's basically this episode now.
Gen wars.
Well, Gen War Z.
Yeah. Look, man, if you start the war, I'm going to be on your side. I'm just saying, it's not going to be me lighting the first fire.
All right. In that revolutionary vein. This one might be too much of a personal joke between me and Seth, but overrated, underrated, Chiang Kai-shek.
Underrated, I think.
Yep. Gotta bring that KMT.
Gotta bring it back, man.
Gotta bring it back.
Well, look at Taiwan, man. Look, I like Taiwan. Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this in despite of Chiang Kai-shek, but yes.
Well, look, let's look at the alternative here. I think this is what we need to talk about here.
All right. That brings our overrated, underrated to a conclusion. Thanks again, Seth, for joining us on our podcast. And thanks to you for listening. This has been episode 17 of the Statistically Insignificant Podcast.